Welcome to the Ghostly Gallery Podcast, a place where we explore the world of horror in film, television, books, and popular culture. Well, greetings, everybody. My name is Bruce Markison. As always, I'm joined by co-host and producer Tracy Asteria. Tracy, what's going on?
Not too much, Bruce, but I wanted to wish you a happy Bat Appreciation Day today. So happy Bat Appreciation Day to you and everybody else.
This is not baseball bats. These are the flying rodents that I have never really cared for. However, it does bring up a horror movie that came out in 1979. We were talking about that off air. It's called Nightwing, and it's actually pretty decent. It's set on a New Mexico reservation where killer bats are invading. It's a Native American reservation. Pretty good cast. Nick Mancuso, David Warner, great British actor, Catherine Harold, Strother Martin, one of the best character actors in history, are all in the film. And it's I would say, slightly above average. I know you haven't seen it, Tracy, but I thought I'd bring that up on this very important holiday, Bat Appreciation Day. What will they come up with next?
Exactly. So that movie is now on my watch list. So thank you for that.
It's out there. It's available for viewing. Nightwing, 1979. All right, enough with bats. On to the main attraction for this week's show. We're very glad to have with us a prolific, talented character actor, Lou Temple. Lou, in the span of 30 years, has compiled nearly 150 credits in film and television. He's had appearances in The Devil's Rejects, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Beginning, the Rob Zombie remake of Halloween. He's done several Rob Zombie movies. Also House of Forbidden Secrets, and an interesting movie that I just saw a couple of months ago called Monstrous with Christina Ricci. Our guest today, Lou, has also appeared in 8 episodes of The Walking Dead, very memorable, playing Axel in that series. And just to get out of the genre for a moment, Lou also had a major role in a terrific action thriller, Unstoppable, with Denzel Washington. Lou, welcome to the Ghostly Gallery. It's great to see you. It's been a few years.
Yeah, so nice to have this time with you both, Bruce and Sandy. Thanks so much, especially on Bat Appreciation Day. which, you know, I feel like that's serendipitous how we picked this day, because I'm a bat fan, interestingly enough. but those will be, as you mentioned, those would typically be baseball bats, Bruce.
Yeah.
Hey, that being said, just to kind of offer my homage to bats on this day of reverence, I just read a script based on a true story by the producer of Monstrous, as a matter of fact, called The Adams Bomb, which was an inventor who was very good friends with Eleanor Roosevelt at the time, that had come up with a plan to release bats with tiny bombs attached to them on Japan, and just start a fire flight, so to speak. And he was convinced this would work. And based on his relationship with the first lady, he was able to get an audience with a few of the generals to at least offer an exhibition of this. And it actually didn't work, but it's crazy the things that inventors will put forth and that we will even consider, like the internet or AI or the bat bomb, which
right.
He was his name was Doc Adams, so they called it the Adams bomb.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness.
That's interesting.
So it's a great character piece. You know, it would be along the lines of a Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? Or it's kind of got a dark comedy to it. You know,
I see.
Crumb, you know, it's perfect for a really good actor. The bats would, you know, I don't know how they're going to do that. But yeah, it's kind of crazy. Look, I wouldn't have brought it up if it wasn't Bat Appreciation Day.
Very
That's
timely.
Priceless.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think there was, I saw on the internet, I was trying to just do some research, but Dan Aykroyd used to have a show that he hosted about crazy ideas on the History Channel. And he actually did a little segment on this.
Oh, wow. My gosh. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it has wings.
Very good. I should mention, I got to know Lou a little bit at the Scaricon convention, which was held in upstate New York for a number of years. Unfortunately, right. it's defunct. Tonight's actually Tracy's first opportunity to talk to you, but this is probably my third or fourth.
Right.
We have common interests, horror and baseball, and we're going to talk about both of them. And with you, I want to talk about your roots, because it's interesting. You're born in Louisiana, but you grew up in Texas. And really, those are two states, Lou, that are associated with the world of horror. And is that just a coincidence, or was that an influence in you wanting to, you know, do horror films?
Yeah, that would be entirely coincidental. I would love to pair that, but it would be a little coincidental as it goes. But you're right. The geography lends itself to some great horror, builds great kind of great horror histories for sure. Not as much a part of my upbringing. So maybe that being said, I loved the monster movies, the Frankensteins, the Draculas, the werewolf, those were always high on the list. I might have stepped out to Hybrid, The Hills Have Eyes, which was really scary for a youngster, obviously. But maybe not as big a fan for me personally growing up as for sure baseball was my first passion. So I didn't really get into acting with an awareness of the horror genre per se. Until the Rob Zombie world sort of presented itself.
Mm.
And I then became more aware of it and what a fan base that it had and how devoted and well-versed the fans were in that genre. So, horror's been great. I was very fortunate to get exposed to some horror legends with, my first swing, so to speak, on The Devil's Rejects. And I still maintain, because of their special skill set, that served that movie kind of capturing lightning in a bottle that Rob was able to do in The Devil's Rejects. And of course, that's Sid Haig, God rest his soul, Bill Moseley, Ken Foray, and William Forsythe. They just have this, it's very interesting and very disarming capability to sort of infringe on your personal space in the camera. And it's just like, even going from heel to toe, just this lean, and I could feel all of us sort of being unnerved in these scenes, and I was watching, what are they doing? And so I feel very fortunate to have been exposed to that early and sort of get a sense of that. And you referenced some of the horror films from the 40s, and I think there was an element of certainly Lugosi and Vincent Price, Lon Chaney, they had this essence about them that I think it's a little lost, but I would definitely say that Sid and Bill, Ken, William, Michael Berryman, they kind of have it. And it's a little throwback and bygone. And we make so much product now that I think some of that gets lost a little bit, but it's real. It's real.
Yeah.
I definitely want to talk more about that film coming up. Tracy has a question in a moment, but I did want to ask one more question about being born in Louisiana. I looked everywhere. I couldn't find a city that you were born in. Every reference just says state of Louisiana. I don't know if you want to keep it secret what the city was, but I'm just curious, you know, did you go to New Orleans? Have you been there? That's one of my cities that I want to go to.
That's where I was raised for the most part. It's a small town in Meade where I was brought up and born. And then my granddad was in New Orleans and we were over with him in the Garden District. So that was wonderful, you know, and I think that you you do sing for your supper there, and there it's pageantry, those of you who've been know. And so it's its own theater every day, all day and night. And it has a personality that gets ingrained in you. And I think the entertainment is just inbred in you. And it's very natural, whether you're a musician or a writer or you're always a storyteller, and you tell a good story and you listen for a good story, and you're always part of that. So that was very natural for me growing up, for sure.
Oh my gosh, the history of that place, I can't even imagine living there. It's on my bucket list one day to actually visit as well. So
yeah, hopefully. You got to get down there and take the Mississippi River, you know, right out of like start up there, New Brunswick, and then just go right down from on, you know, Acadian journey, and you'll be a New Orleanian before you know it.
Oh, it's definitely like right there within the grasp. Holy cow. I do have a quick question. Do you have a personal favorite horror movie that you like to watch, or one that made a huge impression on you, whether as a child or even today?
Yeah. It's Rosemary's Baby. And I assume that, that sort of has set the foundation for what I like in this genre, which is psychological terror, I suppose.
Right.
And so I really appreciate that. And of course, I didn't see that till later. That wasn't probably something I saw as a child. But one thing that I did see that scared me a lot, I mean, like really bothered me, was Dark Shadows.
Oh, really?
The television show, the original. Yeah.
Nice.
And so I don't know how campy that was, or, you know, soap operatic that was, but for a little boy, that was real. And that was frightening, I have to say. You know, Tim Burton's remake, I don't know. It was different. That's the truth. It was fine, but it was different. Or maybe I was different. Yeah. But definitely Rosemary's Baby. I thought that was really terrifying.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's fascinating. And that's pretty darn cool about Dark Shadows, too. We've been talking to Ansel Farage, who is,
wow,
you know, a director who has done a lot of projects with some of the Dark Shadow cast. So that is such a cool connection. Absolutely.
Yeah, they're amazing. And I don't know. I think that show is there was nothing like it at the time. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. It seemed very cutting edge for, you know, its time.
Absolutely. It was a soap opera about a vampire, not originally, but when they brought Jonathan Frid, the great Canadian actor, in to play Barnabas Collins, that's what it really became.
Yeah.
Those are great choices. Dark Shadows and Rosemary's Baby. Lou, for many years, it was baseball. That was your dream. You're still a fan of the game, but you were a standout player in college. Then you did some scouting for major league clubs. You became assistant director of minor league operations for the Houston Astros. So you had a very significant career doing this before you went into acting. What was life like for you working in baseball?
Well, you know, if you want to call that work, then it was awful. But if it wasn't, it was pure joy being able to be exposed to something that I'd loved ever since I was a little boy. I think what was really interesting was that I didn't really understand all that I was you know, getting exposed to. It was kind of in the moment, and the more responsibility you're willing to take on, the more people are willing to give it to you in an organization. I assume in the corporate world, that's very similar. It is the corporate world ultimately. So I got to do so many things and got to see so many great baseball players and baseball personnel and be around people. And so it was a fantasy come true. It was really great. I loved looking at players as a scout, projecting them to see if they were going to be the caliber of players that could be a Houston Astro, which is who I was working for in Houston. And I loved, seeing them from high school become major league players and then on to incredible careers. It's amazing. A couple of these guys. So for instance, Craig Biggio, who I saw at Seton Hall University, went on obviously to have not just a career, but a Hall of Fame career. And now his son is a player, you know, with the Toronto Blue Jays. So we got, look, let's see what I did there. I got Cooperstown. I got Canada. We've got them all connected there. So it was an amazing experience. And I got to understand how decisions were made, how difficult some decisions are, how frivolous others' decisions were. I got to recognize the mano a mano of baseball, you know, that at the end of the day, it's me against you. And I saw, you know, incredible baseball games and still do. Baseball is still a great game, great sport. I enjoy reading about the history of baseball as much as I did when I was a boy, which I did a ton of. And so, yeah, it was a perfect, so if an alien came down to visit and wanted to say, what's life like on Earth, I might take them to a baseball game and say, now what you do here is you just relax. We're going to visit a lot and we'll notice the game. And after 9 innings, you'll have had an experience that I think is relatable to the human experience. That's for me, baseball.
Interesting. I have to ask, did you recommend that the Astros draft and then eventually sign Craig Biggio?
Well, I was part of it, so I got to see him. It's interesting that every time I would go see him, which was typically in Florida, so that Seton Hall would come down for their Florida spring trip, and I'd see him play over at UCF often, University of Central Florida, and he always bunted. And I knew that he could run, and he was a catcher, and I was like, this guy really is athletic, and he can run. I've never seen him swing the bat. He was really a great athlete that would do anything to get on base. So I definitely thought he was dynamic. I don't think that I saw him being a Hall of Fame second baseman, center fielder, catcher. But thankfully, we had a scout who did. Clary Anderson, who was up out of the New Jersey area and was also a very dear personal friend of our owner, John McMullen. And so when we took this guy, Clary just went in and signed him, gave him whatever he wanted. And we were like, whoa, you can't throw that kind of money around. And believe me, as everyone knows, that was probably the best money Houston ever spent. One of the guys I did recommend signing was Luis Gonzalez, who was at South Alabama. And he was playing third base, which he never really played for us. But I just thought he would be a good major league hitter. And he turned out to be a really good major league hitter. He ended up winning the World Series. And he's a great Diamondback, a great Marlin.
Yeah.
And Louis was great. So many interesting players that I got to see and be around and so many of them have had great careers. So a lot of them haven't also, by the way. There are guys that were high on my list that never saw the light of day. Believe me, I was wrong about way more than I was right about.
Well, hey, Luis Gonzalez, good player, had a very nice career. And just to show you that you can always make a connection between baseball and horror, and in this case, the Hall of Fame, Wade Boggs, the Hall of Fame third baseman, was once in a horror movie. I forget the name of it. I think it was a made-for-sci-fi, and it was set in the swamps of Louisiana. And he plays, I want to say, like a trooper or a policeman with a Southern accent. And he's only in it for a few minutes, but he's pretty darn good. I don't know if you've seen it, but yeah, Wade Boggs did a horror movie, believe it or not.
I'm trying to think of what that would have been, but so let me ask you, did you investigate the credits at all? Was he listed as an executive producer that he might have thrown a little money at it? And hey, as long as I'm investing in this, I should do a role.
I didn't do that. I should have, but
that happens some of the time.
I see. Yeah, that's part of the deal. We'll give you money, but you got to put me in.
Yeah, for sure. Or yeah. Hey, if you give us money, we'll be happy to put you in. We've got this great role of yeah. state trooper. You know why I pulled you over? Yeah. Yeah. Now Boggs would be great. He's an interesting. He's a really fun, good-hearted, good-natured dude. I've been around him a little bit, so. As long as there's chicken available for lunch, he's happy.
Right. He did a good job in the movie. I was really quite impressed, but certainly better than a lot of actors who used to be athletes. So, Lou, why'd you decide to leave the game? You worked for the Astros. You had a pretty good job there, but you decided to leave and pursue a career in acting. How'd that come about?
Yeah, I think it's a good story. I'll try to keep it brief. I was in Houston, Texas. I had a career as the assistant director of minor leagues and scouting, and I was moving up the ladder. I'm sure I would have been a department head and or a general manager at some point, company car, expense account. And one afternoon, early evening, I followed a young lady into a building to inquire as to her dinner plans. And it was a theater. And I walked in and they were on stage rehearsing, or it ultimately was an acting class. And I'm like, those are my people. That's where I belong. Which was ridiculous because I didn't know anything about that world. I didn't even grow up really thinking about actors being real people. I actually thought they were Steve Austin, the $6 million man, was real. You know, I never thought that there was an actor portraying those guys. But along the way, I got a call to come down to the Houston Astrodome in uniform with some bats and balls from the owner of the Astros at the time. And typically that meant we were going to try some people out. This is very shortly after I got exposed to this acting class. I signed up for some night classes and I met this guy who was not trying out, but was doing a movie in Houston called The Chase. His name was Charlie Sheen, and he needed to prepare for Major League 2, which he was going to go do after this movie. So he would rent the Astrodome and work out with me after he was done filming in preparation. And so I was at one of his birthday parties very early in Houston, and two gentlemen from Disney flew in to celebrate with Charlie, amongst others, whom I met, and they were doing a movie called Angels in the Outfield, and they talked me into coming to California to do their movie. And so I took some time off from the Astros. It was in the winter. We filmed in Oakland and in Los Angeles, and at that time, the team was sold. And there was a new general manager that took over who was a gentleman that I knew. His name was Bob Watson, the old, the ex-first baseman from Bad News Bears. Let them kids play. Let the kids play. And Bob called and said, hey, Lou boy, you don't have to, you don't have to come home too soon. You know, don't worry. I know you're enjoying California. And I was like, that doesn't sound good. I better get back. So I came back and Bob said, look, you know, you're a baseball lifer like the rest of us, and you're going to stay in this game forever, and it's already heading that way. But I see this other interest you have, maybe in acting, and I'm telling you, if you don't get out now, you'll never pursue this. So it's not that I'm firing you. I'm just not rehiring you. And I was pissed. And I was like, come on. And he kind of kicked me out of the nest. I got a call from the San Diego Padres with a job offer to come run one of their departments, scouting. And his voice just kind of echoed in my back of my mind that maybe I could give it a try. So I didn't take that job, and I went back to school at Brooklyn College and learned acting, actually, and started pursuing work in theater in Texas, and just started to make my way to here I am. So that was really interesting to have had a career that you'd love to have in baseball, and then also to have this career in acting as well. So I often give credit not just to the girl that I was going to chat up for a date, but also Bob Watson, who has passed on as well now, God rest his soul. Because he did put a bug in my ear about maybe I should try this. Yeah.
Ended up pushing you in the right direction. It ended up working out, even though you were not happy at first.
Totally not happy. You know, I don't, but I'm not sure that I would have ever left baseball, Bruce. You know how baseball is. So it is a lifer game. And most of my friends have spent their entire careers and since retired. But it's a great, you know, it's a great national pastime, really.
Yeah, absolutely. So you make the decision, go from baseball to acting. Did you feel pressure because it was a late start for you in Hollywood?
I suppose I never thought about actually going to Hollywood. I just thought if I can just be a regional guy and do some of this theater, which I was able to kind of secure some roles. I was able to, you know, Texas is a great place to get experience and local hire. And there was a television show, Walker, Texas Ranger, that was being shot up in Dallas with Chuck Norris that I got to work on. That was great. There was enough of an independent film scene with Richard Linklater and Robert Rodriguez kind of at the beginning of their careers. I got to, you know, be exposed to them a little bit. And I was just happy enough and not thinking about Hollywood too much. And then I did a movie, and all the guys we got were Hollywood guys. We're living in Hollywood, and they're like, Lou, you definitely should be out here. And my girlfriend at the time dumped me, and I had no reason to stay in Texas. So I did make that move. Right around 2000, I came out here to Hollywood.
It's not easy.
Bruce, back to your question about like a late start. I always felt like I had a lot of life to bring that others had not. So I sort of fooled myself into believing where youth wasn't on my side, experience was. And so that I just used it as a secret weapon. I'm not sure it ever really was, but it was a game I played in my head that worked for me.
Yeah. You know, acting is not an easy thing to do. Maybe it's easier than playing baseball in the major leagues, which is really hard. But acting is obviously a tough skill that not everybody has. But it seems like you made the transition pretty darn well.
Yeah. Again, I feel like one of the great things, a skill set that I have that I'm aware of is observation. So I'm able to kind of see. And I think that comes from scouting, from looking at players and evaluating the situation, evaluating the talent around me and compartmentalizing where do I fit in? Where is that person? How do I measure up against that person? I recognized immediately on the field just how that guy's different. And also, then I'm able to assess how do I survive on the field? How do I keep getting to play? So I kind of did the same thing with acting and recognized, okay, here's what I do. And here's what I do best. And how does this serve the industry that might want to hire me? And so I feel like that was great. Interesting. So the things that I talk to young people getting started about are the things I wish that I would have known then, is that you spend a lot of time trying to be what you think others want you to be, auditioning for Axl, auditioning for Ned Oldham, you know, auditioning for these roles on the page. And ultimately, the people that are deciding on hiring you are just looking for who you are. They're really just trying to sort out for who you are. And so if you can get a grip on that first, you'll be exponentially ahead of everyone else, just having a good, secure understanding of who you are and bringing that to the party. Like dating, you know, it's just, you know, like your mother taught you, just be yourself and be nice. And so and being nice never has anything to do with it, by the way. but being yourself really does. So, and when you go, when you come out of a regional area, the pressure that you feel, Bruce, is to be all things to all people. And yeah, I can tap dance, I can ride a horse, I can smoke a cigarette, I can, you know, and at the end of the day, I'm never going to get hired for my British accent, am I? No, you know, I'm not at all. I'm going to be hired for who I am. I am how I'm drawn. And so that takes a long time to figure out, by the way. So that's an experience thing.
Right. Lou, you were about 9-10 years into your acting career when you received medical diagnosis, very serious. I didn't know about this when I first met you at Scarecon. I only found out about it recently in doing preparation for this interview. Tell us about the diagnosis of leukemia that you had to deal with.
Yeah. Wow. That was obviously life-changing. It's an awakening. You know, you don't ever wake up thinking, my gosh, I don't feel well. I wonder if I have cancer. That's not typically your go-to, and it certainly wasn't mine, which meant that I just put it off or brushed it off. As a young person, we do this. You take your car in to the mechanics before you go see a doctor. So I figured out every way to not be diagnosed with, you know, I've got a virus or I've got a bug. So I really let myself get sick. And my friends were noticing quite a bit. And I came to Houston to do a job. It was an independent film. And, you know, I was very lethargic and I'd been sick for months. You know, and it was very bronchial, and I was losing weight. I was really thin, and I didn't look good. And so they actually called my agent and said, hey, he doesn't look good on camera. We're going to let him go. Which, you know, had never happened to me before. And I was, you know, I was upset that I was sicker than I was upset. And thankfully a friend of mine, who I was staying with in Houston, a gentleman named Jason Douglas, who's had a great career on his own. He was on The Walking Dead for many years. And he said, look, I'm taking you to the hospital. And I said, well, I'm not going to the hospital. I'm going back to Los Angeles. He goes, I'm bigger than you and I can physically take you in or you can go. And I said, okay, well, I'm not staying the night. And I didn't. I stayed like 8 months at MD Anderson after the diagnosis. So I went through every angle of being sick and being last rites read to miraculous turnaround and the whole gamut of life leaving and returning. And so it is a perspective that I'd like everyone to have, but without, you know, doing the time. You know, what's this, the old saying is, you can beat the rat, but you can't beat the ride. And so I wouldn't want anyone to have the ride, but I love everyone to have the perspective, because it does let you know how important life is and how important you are to other people. And it was amazing. You know, it was terrifying. It was enlightening. It was hilarious in some regards. I was chemo, and it's just this close to stem cell treatment, and it was I was fortunate to be at a cancer research center that was able to diagnose my my type of leukemia, hairy cell leukemia, and get me into treatment right away to attend to it. And so I speak to it often. From there in the year 2000 to where we're at today, you know, cancer treatment is light years ahead of where it was. And I'm so grateful for that. So I always say cancer is not a four letter word. It's definitely a six letter word that is doable. And, and I'm, it's just the experience of it in so many ways keeps giving, so to speak. And so I got to learn a lot about myself, other people, friends, family, and still do to this day. So I'm always available to speak on it. That's the truth. And, you know, as you get older, you start having more of that experience in your life. For some reason, as we, as gravity sets in, cancer does show up a little bit more. And so I talk to more friends and family that are dealing with it, you know, and I always reference, well, okay, let's roll our sleeves up and we're going to beat this. You get to be a superhero just like me, you know? And so it's an adventure. I look at it as the adventure of getting well, the adventure of getting well, not the adventure of getting sick or being sick.
Right.
Lou, did the doctors at any point say, we don't think you're going to make it?
Yeah, for sure.
Wow.
And they wouldn't necessarily tell me, Bruce, but they would tell the people around me, and I could read that on their faces. And I knew that I was in trouble, and I wasn't sure how it was going to go. And I think I was very afraid, but I also had enough of a support system to take care of what was bothering me, which, you know, when you're in that situation, I think what you do is you're in a state of denial a little bit. So you focus on little weird stuff like your cell phone bill, or your, I've got a parking ticket I haven't paid. Damn it. I got to get that paid. You know what? And like, dude, you might not make it through the night, you know, just don't worry about that.
Right.
So that experience tells you a lot about who you are. Also, you know, I was fairly young, and you could see people that were your age that would come visit you. They were seeing themselves, and the mortality of their life was before them looking at, And just to share with you, which I don't mind, and at some point, I was visited by, and you're visited by so many strangers, by the way, and a stranger came to my room and asked how I was, and then, you know, most times you don't know, and I was so sick, I didn't know, nor did I care, and I said, I don't think I'm doing very well. He goes, I heard that. Yeah, her doctors told me. And I'm like, yeah. Never thought to ask why he was there. He says, well, look, how you fixed for down the road, the afterlife. And I'm like, I don't know. I guess I'm a believer. I'm a Christian, vaguely. And he said, can we pray? And I said, yeah, why not? And look, Bruce, the minute that we did, all the burden of living or dying was literally removed from me. I felt like I was elevated in my bed. The blinding sunlight came through in a February day. And from that point on, I wasn't worried, or I wasn't anxious, and I wasn't burdened by trying to live or trying to die. It was always going to be okay. And some miracles start happening, you know, so that's the experience that I like sharing with everybody. And wow. That's a big experience for me. Interestingly enough, my wife, we met because someone thought it was a good idea that we should tell a story that we had to tell to one another. So we lived in the same building, her underneath me. It was very breakfast at Tiffany's in Hollywood here at the Villa Carlotta, famous luminary hotel, apartment complex here in town. And when we did have lunch, we were trying to figure out what we, and then she offered, well, I'm a leukemia survivor at Cedars-Sinai Hospital at the exact same time that I was. And it just was like kismet, serendipitous. And so we spent all day talking about our experiences and kindred spirit and married shortly thereafter. And then, of course, never were medically supposed to, with all the chemo and radiation, to procreate. And we had no trouble at all having a child, just a little miracle daughter. So all blessings and a great story, really, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Last question on this topic, Lou. It's 20 years later.
Yeah.
You're still with us. Thank you. Have to go in for regular checkups still?
I don't. I made a decision that when I, that was a part of my life. And you know, I went through all the appropriate protocol for going through remission, following up. But at some point, 10 years on, I decided, look, that was, I'm going to live my life. I'm going to live our life. And so I'm not going to hearken back to it or be restricted or, you know, totally respectful. There's an interesting, I've always wanted I've always wanted to write a story about the experience of cancer, recognizing that it is part of you. It's not a monster that showed up out of nowhere. It is part of you, and you're going to go into those dark woods, and hopefully you're going to come out, but that monster or what you deem is not. And so I had to make psychologically, I had to make peace with that person, that thing that was trying to live with me. And the both of us weren't going to be able to survive. One of us was going to have to be put down as it goes. And so I recognize that you end up making, I think part of not being in denial is recognizing that you're sick. It's more than just working out or, you know, getting through it. It is recognizing you're sick. It's not a physical, I'm going to get through this. It's a mental. And you've got to give over to your physicians and your faith, and a village gets you through it. It's not something you do privately and quietly, and I'll get through this, because it, when you're sick like that, it's it can be shameful. You're ashamed that you've put your loved ones through and your caretakers through all of this. And so you have to get through that. So I needed to make friends with my cancer and leukemia and recognize and honor it in its death and then leave it, you know? And so that was my way of, so I've always thought that would be a really good story. Maybe science fiction, you know, somehow, you know, making friends with the monster that's killing you, which is you, and in essence, you know, it's rogue blood cells that have split inside of you and been cancer. A very abstract way, very poetic artist way of looking at it, but it worked for me.
Well, it's a remarkable story, a remarkable comeback, and there's, I guess, maybe some luck involved, but you certainly deserve credit too for
thank you.
The work that definitely. You had to put. There's got to be some determination, a will to live. You obviously
when things are tough, you know, and they whatever those things are. So I mentioned, you know, how we've been on these strikes and these pauses, and and had an we're experiencing what they call contraction now in the industry, where the industry's rebooting. And this is, for most of us in the industry, there's a lot of uncertainty and difficulty. We've already been through it and we're continuing. We're not in full recovery yet. And so an experience like I have, what it's supposed to be there for is to remind me, hey, remember, you've been through this and you made it for a reason. Don't give up now. Let's not get too down about any particular thing. This is just traffic. You know, that's just a guy that cuts you off. Remember. And so it's a great post-it note that I never fail to see. It's always right there. Right. So
let's talk about some less important things, but things that are kind of fun. Some of the movies you've done, and I want to pick up your earlier conversation about The Devil's Rejects, which came out back in 2005. I just rewatched it the other night. It's an absolutely wild film. I mean, the three main killers are the most reprehensible, disgusting, horrific creatures that the human race has probably ever produced. And I have read that when you were first contacted about this movie, working for director Rob Zombie, supposedly you said that you were scared to death of working with him. Is that true?
Yeah, well, I was very uncertain because I didn't know Rob, and I kind of knew White Zombie, and when I went into audition for it, a lot of people were there to audition, and good people. Jeremy Davies, Steve Zahn, you know, guys I really liked. So it got my attention, like, wow, this is for real. This is a real project. Because I had read the very first page where there's this giant dragging a dead girl through the woods and she's nude. And I was like, holy shit, can you do that? And I called my friend who had done House of a Thousand Corpses, Walton Goggins. And I said, Walton, I'm just a good Southern boy. You know that. And I'm not sure I'm going to be able to go work for this devil worshiper, Rob Zombie. He's like, you're an idiot. What's wrong with you? He said, Rob is amazing. Do yourself a favor. Artistically, it's going to be the best movie you ever make. And personally, you're going to have a friend for life who's a super cool dude. And truer words have never been spoke. And so, yeah, I was nervous through ignorance. And when we showed up at the table read, as I had mentioned, you know, it was like the Super Bowl of table reads, and Sid brought it that very first, you know, bang. And we all were sitting at the table going, oh, dang, we better bring our A game because Mr. Haig will accept nothing less. And Bill Moseley, same thing. And keep in mind, I was working with Jeffrey Lewis, who I had known of through all the Clint Eastwood movies. In fact, Jeffrey gave me a card that said Clint Eastwood's best friend, which was awesome. It was awesome. He was so much fun. And he and I would just, he would talk and I would listen and just engage in, you know, so that in its own way, that was a masterclass in and of itself. So for instance, he would say, you know, when you're talking in a scene with the lead, always put your hand on his shoulder when you have lines. That way they can't cut you out of the move. And, you know, or when you go into audition, stand on your tiptoes in the door frame when you walk in. That way you look a little taller than you actually are. You know, just great, interesting little tricks of the trade. He was so much fun, just a delight. And, of course, he's Juliette Lewis's father and Deidre Lewis as well. And really lovely. And that was just wonderful. And then I spent a lot of time with Bill Moseley too, sort of picking his brain about this genre, really this genre. And he was great. Everyone was great. It was crazy. And Rob was great. And I don't know. There's something about that movie where I feel like it was the build and every character had a little arc of life. And Rob was fully available and interested in developing those arcs. Even, you know, even the guy selling the chickens, you know, had a life. And so I just thought it was so many delicious moments in that movie by in performances. And Rob was very skilled and very available to do those things. So, you know, he would ask me, he would inquire and I would offer. So what would happen if you saw somebody get shot? I'd probably lose my lunch, Rob. I'm not sure, but okay, that's good. Do you, bring the Campbell's clam chowder. Lou, we're going to have you just throw up in this scene. Just crazy stuff. And everybody, the intensity of that scene in the hotel with Priscilla Barnes and Bill Moseley was ratcheted so high that it was frightening. It was for real. That was just the level of work that was being put forth. It was amazing. I can't tell that you two, and if you've seen, there's a documentary called 30 Days in Hell. It kind of outlines it a little bit, I think, on what used to be the DVDs, extras on it. So it was super cool. And I remember our first day, we were so excited that we were all way big, way over the top. And he's like, "Hey, Lou, come here. Yeah, I'm going to need you to bring that down a little bit." I'm like, "Rob, I'm wearing an orange shirt. How can I bring it down?" You know, but it was great. It was such an experience. And I think a special experience and special movie that arguably can be called kind of a cult classic, right?
Yeah. In that scene in the motel room before you and your wife and the bandmates are attacked, you're there with a baseball and a glove and you're patting the ball into your glove. Was that your idea?
Of course, that was a me thing. I mean, I'm not saying Rob's not a baseball fan, but I was like, "Well, Rob, can I have like a ball glove, you know, just to give this guy a little character besides being a musician?" Cause we loaded in a lot of equipment, but there were no scenes of us playing. I'm like, he's like, "Yeah, if you think that's cool." And I'm like, "Yeah, that's so cool."
Yeah.
And that's what I mean about Rob being available for things like that. And so the thing was, is for Adam Banjo, I recognized, what was important was to have this arc where he's full of bravado and machismo, and then the proverbial shit hits the fan and he kind of gets put in his place and puts on his wife's skirt, so to speak, where she's taking care of him. And then now he's got to rise up courageously and confront the hero, the monster, right? And win or lose in a blaze of glory, if you will. And so, you know, I kind of outlined all that to Rob, what I saw, and Rob's like, "Yeah, let's go with that. Let's go with that." So a lot of that, there's definitely some blueprinted on the page, but a lot of it is improv and building to that place where when Roy and I, or Jeffrey Lewis and I are fighting for our lives, it looks like we're going to win and we should have won.
Yeah.
You know, had that guy with the around the neck and, you know, all of a sudden the knife, which, by the way, is another interesting story. Kane Hodder was our stunt coordinator. Have you had Kane on the show yet?
No, have not.
He's a great guy to have. We were doing a scene. Rob wanted to just do an insert of the knife being pulled. So it needed to be the real knife and have a special glint off the blade. But prior to that, all the scenes that we had done in the stunt rehearsals and in the shots were the retractable knife where it goes up into the hilt. In this particular, it was the real knife. The scene was going really great. Rob didn't say cut, none of us. So ultimately, it was setting up that Lou Temple was going to get stabbed in the groin. And Kane came rushing in and broke the scene. Rob was pissed. "Why did you, you know, that scene was, it's a real knife. Lou's, you know, probably wants kids at some point." So that was interesting. and then just the yelling for Roy, "Roy, are you okay?" You know, there's just sort of that pain for all of us that these two didn't, they didn't make it. They didn't win. And, but maybe they died nobly. And I really appreciate that. The work on that day, I'm sure you saw, in the Palmdale, California, on a real chicken ranch, smelled terrible, as hot as all hell. And Bill's cutting my face off and they're pumping blood through me. Wayne Toth is Rob's special effects guy, and he's sparing no blood. It's sticky as hell. There's flies and bugs and bees everywhere. And I keep spinning up or spinning it in Bill's face, you know, and he's got this hair. Now we do a reset, which means Bill's got to get all cleaned up again. And Bill was pissed at me. I was pissed at him. So we weren't that far off from being really agitated, to be honest. But it worked really well.
One last question on this movie. I've got to ask you about Bill Moseley. He's Otis Driftwood. I've seen him in the three movies. Is he crazy in real life? He scares me. Is he crazy?
No. It's so far from it. He's very intelligent, well-spoke guy. He is, and I'm not going to be able to come up with the word, but he is an enthusiast of insects. So there's a scientific word that references somebody that's a study of insects. He goes about on walks to seek out and look at Delphide Aphrodemenos or whatever. And he's really interested in that. He's very relaxed and kind. He's got a cutting sense of humor that is sharp. You know, he comes from a study background. He's a science guy. You know, he's just this side of Bill Nye the Science Guy. He wrote for a company called Scientific Journal prior to being an actor. He's interviewed Tim Leary. He's really, really nothing like Otis Driftwood. And so where good that comes from, yeah, where that comes from is fascinating. I find that he's somebody that told me, you know, and this was a time when I was really paying attention to the advice I was getting because I was pretty young in my career. And he said, look, I do horror films because this is a place that I can actually do some work outside of, you know, he went that away, or am I a studio film? I'm kind of pinned in, but I can really build a character here. And so, and that shows from Chop Top to Otis to everything that he's done. And yeah, he's very invested on set, and then he's really easy to leave that all behind till tomorrow. He's really great at that.
Yeah.
Good dude. Super good dude. Really smart, really intelligent guy. Way more intelligent than the characters he plays.
Interesting. Maybe we'll have to get him as a guest.
I think so.
We could learn from. Yeah.
Knows a lot.
About a year later.
The railway system. He's really into America's railroad history.
Well, that fits in with a later movie that we're going to talk about briefly, Unstoppable. But before I get to that, two more horror movies I want to mention. One came out 2006. I think it's really underrated. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Beginning. It's with Jordana Brewster, Matt Bomer, and the late R. Lee Ermey. Did you get to know Mr. Ermey?
I did. Yeah, I had worked with him on an indie film before called On the Borderline, and just had a hoot with Lee. And he was special, obviously. You know, he was a real gunny sergeant. We all know his story and history. And at some point, he stayed over and was making B movies in Korea, like doing B Korean horror films that were being studied by Oliver Stone in preparation for Full Metal Jacket. He's like, this guy that's an American that keeps showing up, I want him. And so that sort of discovered Lee. And he was just great. And he could read a phone book and make it sound perfect, right? So we struck up a friendship, and he would call me. He had a boat in Marina Del Rey, and young hard charger, you will meet me at 0800 hours. You will bring both kinds of music, country and Western. I will see you there. Don't be late. You know, and it would just be like, I would save it on my answer machine. Oh, you got to hear this. You got to hear this. He was lovely. He was so much fun. And then when we did Texas Chainsaw, we were kind of everybody was kind of young. And Andrew and Benarski and myself and Lee, we had those scenes together. And so we kind of missed the kiddie core at that point. But it was crazy. The big thing was, like, I was this state trooper and I needed to, I had pulled over Tommy Leatherface and needed to get my trooper's hat off. And because I needed to be able to have a CGI effect getting shot in the head.
Hmm.
And the whole conversation about why would I take my hat off and set it on the hood of the car? You know, why would I? Well, because we have to, because otherwise the CGI is not going to work. So these are the kinds of things that happen in films all the time, is the logic. So an actor, when he can't figure out the logic, then all of a sudden he's not committing to it and it looks bullshit. So finally, Andrew, the director, figured something out and it worked okay. But all of those, that ride, and we weren't revealing Lee up to that point. You know, we didn't know who that guy was. He was kind of nefariously the Shadow. And then he takes my identity, actually. He takes my sheriff's uniform and becomes what he becomes. That was just a lot of fun. So a lot of improv in that as well. And we shot that in Austin, Texas. And I do think that film, for me, it was way more violent than The Devil's Rejects, like gruesomely violent, Bruce.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I thought. I mean, you know, we stabbed some people. We showed some body mutilation. But Texas Chainsaw, I was like, holy shit. You know, we did that. Oh, no. But yeah, I was surprised at how gruesome it was.
Yeah. Pretty cool that you got to go back to Texas to film that. That must have been nice as well. Yeah.
So Bruce, I've dealt with Otis, and Tracy, you'll have a good answer to this too. And I've dealt with Leatherface. We might talk about it later, but I have had a little parlay with Michael Myers. Am I missing Freddy or am I missing Jason? If I'm to get a trifecta,
you have to get Freddy.
Okay.
Have to get Freddy. Absolutely. He is a total icon.
Good to know. Good to know. I'll work on that. Are they doing Jason remakes anymore?
Actually, I think I read something about a revival of a TV series with Friday the 13th. So
that would make sense. That'd be good. Yeah. Maybe I can get into that world. Yeah.
That would be pretty cool, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with Tracy. I think Freddie would be my choice. You ever work with Robert Englund?
I have not.
Okay.
I have. I've been around Robert a lot, but and also, as you know, a real intelligent man and a scholar and Shakespearean actor. And he's a delight. I've been around him a lot out at the conventions. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Well, a year after Texas Chainsaw, you go back to Rob Zombie with his remake of Halloween.
Ah.
And you mentioned how much you enjoyed the first go round. So you have a second chance here. It's a small role, but you're paired with another memorable actor, Danny Trejo.
Yeah. Well, after Rob had hired Tyler Mane, which I think was his first hire, you got to get your Michael in there. And I'm not just going to have a stunt performer. I'm going to have an actor that I want to really do this role. He hired Danny and I. We were one of the first group that were cast. And he said, basically, Rob was like, you know, this time I want Danny, you're going to be the sweetheart. And Lou, you're going to be the asshole. And I was like, what? Come on. He said, no, I know you'll do a good job. So it was great. And Danny's lovely. If you've been around him, he's such a grateful guy. He has his story, which is built on gratitude and second chance, and not unlike my second chance. And so He's just wonderful to be around and really a fine actor. He's great at improv. He's really good on his feet. And so I pushed a lot of buttons, you know, you're not the boss of me and you and your Latin heritage, you guys are good at sweeping up. That's not what I do. And just made Noel Klugs as unlikable as I possibly could. I had a real reason for that, just an upbringing thing. And also I wanted to get Michael Myers, this big oaf, under my thumb, typical of what little guys do. You know, if I can make him do something bad and ugly, I'll be able to control him, which is what I wanted to do. And so a lot of backstory with that. And of course, Courtney Gaines was in there as my cousin, and we were going to do this very ugly scene with one of the patients at Smithville Institution, of which we did, which was really intense, obviously, a rape scene, and wanted to get Michael Myers involved in it. And that went south on us, and Michael escapes. And when the Weinsteins, of all people, saw this, Harvey particularly, nervous about how the female audience would react, and asked Rob if there was an alternative. And Rob was like, well, you know, it might cost you, and I'd have to get some, you know, might have to bring Bill Moseley and Leslie Easterbrook and Tom Tolles in. And they're like, yeah, fine. And so that was disappointing for me, but gratifying that Rob puts it on his director's cut. Really intense. The worst thing I'd done on screen for sure. That was the kind of role that I just couldn't wipe off me enough when I'd come home at night. And I thought that would be the last of that. You know, Malcolm McDowell was helpful there. Again, I like to reference people who have offered good counsel. And he just said, you know, it's your job. If you have to play Adolf Hitler, you've got to do it great. You know, do it with the plum. And I was like, okay. That was the worst until my next Rob Zombie movie, which was 31 and Psycho Head, bar none. And the difference is I found reason and backstory for Noel and just wasn't able to make reason or sense why these people were so miserable in 31. Just, you know, so I just decided to rip off a line from Rob and his song Dragula and just scream out while I'm getting chopped in half with a chainsaw that I will never die, you know. So, but yeah, Halloween was great. We were definitely trying to pay homage to the original and be respectful and also give a backstory. And definitely Rob got some blowback for that, you know. But I thought we did a good job. And at the time that it came out, it was the all-time opening record for Labor Day. I'm sure that's been really? Broke since now. But back then at $58 million for an opening weekend on Labor Day, that was really good. So, yeah, that was a great experience. And then obviously, you know, we Rob totally wanted to be respectful of John Carpenter and have his blessing. So, and then of course he does the next one, which I think was more about prepping him for sort of his Rosemary's Baby, so to speak, very psychologically bizarre.
Let's depart horror for just a moment. Probably of all the mainstream films that you've done, this is maybe the best. It's an outstanding movie, Unstoppable, made in 2010, or it came out in 2010. And you had a chance to work with really one of the great actors of our era, Denzel Washington. How was that?
Wow, it was amazing. Again, that's just a lesson, an acting lesson, a life lesson. And so, but it's not one where he pulls you aside and says, now look, kid, it's the unspoken. You have to pay attention. And then at dinner later in the night, you think about it and go, huh? Oh, wow. Interestingly, I'm running around like a monkey chasing a football. Denzel's doing nothing. And he steals the scene. I should take note. He was great. And you know, he had come off The Taking of Pelham with John Travolta, and it didn't do as well as they had hoped with two big names like that. And so there was this kind of talk in the air that Denzel couldn't pull it off anymore. You know, it's time to pass it on to the young guy. And so he's like, okay, give me the best young guy you got. And at that point, it was kind of Chris Pine or Renner, or, you know, and so we got Chris, and Denzel pulled it off, right? And he's great. And so's Chris. And to be, you know, Chris and I would go to dinner, and Denzel hates us. I'm not sure he does, but he probably does. But, you know, we didn't realize until later what lessons we were getting. And of course, that was working with Tony Scott, right? And which was just delightful. It was like working for Willy Wonka. You know, for the most part, that movie's practical out there in Pennsylvania, Ohio, in that Rust Belt on the railways. And that's real steel. You know, there's a little CGI in a couple of those shots, but for the most part, that's all in camera. So that is an action movie that played a lot during the pandemic and still holds up. It keeps you on the edge of your seat. And again, I had the good fortune to work with a director who believed enough in me to be able to believe in my madness of what I was trying to do, which was to be an island amongst a man on his own island in the cab of that truck. And so I'm going to keep going forward. I'm going to chase the snake down the rabbit hole. And I don't know how or what I'm going to do when it comes time, but I'm going to just keep trying. And I got to be part of the hero group, which I seldom get to be in. It was wonderful. And to be engaging inside of a truck cab when you're just there by yourself and you're not really working with other actors, and maybe you've got a phone, or it's a certain amount of balls to keep in the air to do it engagingly. And I was very fortunate that Tony allowed me that to get off the leash. He didn't have to give me the leeway that he did. And I'm proud of what we were able to do and to be a part of that.
That's amazing. You've had so many great experiences.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine. But if you're up to it, can we talk about your role in The Walking Dead for a few minutes?
Yeah.
You played Axel in, you know, a historical, actually, The Walking Dead is just an icon of a show in TV history. What were your thoughts of getting the role in heading to a show that was going into its third season with a well-established cast?
Yeah, interesting. I had seen the graphic novels. They come across my desk because they're in the horror genre, and I thought they were ultra-violent and violent, and that they would never build these because it's way too, they can't show stuff like this on television. Ha! And then originally I was brought in by casting to read for the role of Merle, that great monologue he has on the roof. And thankfully, Michael Rooker was the choice there. And then weeks later, they brought me back, maybe even a couple months later. It's probably a month later. They brought me back to read for Merle's brother, who doesn't have any lines or even a name, but just read that same monologue, but do it different as if you were his brother. And thankfully, they found Norman Reedus to become Daryl. So by the time Axel came around, they knew who I was at the very least. They sent some dummy sides. It was about Axel and T-Dog having a conversation about facial hair, oddly. And I thought that was weird. So, but I did all right. And I was doing Lone Ranger at the time for Gore Verbinski and Disney. And when I got hired to do The Walking Dead, and I had a big mustache, a cowboy mustache, a handlebar, and I wasn't done. And I'm like, look, I can't shave this. And they're like, yeah, that's fine. We like your mustache. I'm like, you say that, but I know you're going to ask me to shave. And I wasn't sure. I didn't pass on it, but I was like, I don't know. I don't think you guys really want me because I got this other. They're like, no, we totally come do this. And I said, okay. And I know Norman from in town here. And so I showed up on set, and I couldn't find Norman Reedus's trailer. And I'm like, oh, he plays Daryl. So maybe it's a Daryl. I didn't see Daryl. And all these weird names like Godzilla and Tyrannosaurus Rex and, you know, Mr. Magoo and all these weird names on trailers that were not. And I'm like, man, I've been duped. This is probably some webisode of The Walking Dead or something. And then Norman shows up and he's like, yeah, we're kind of trying to fly under the radar over here. And I'm like, wow, why? He goes, don't you know? And I'm like, nope. And he said, it's getting really popular. I was like, oh, wow. Okay, cool. That's good. And then Andrew Lincoln came out and invited me to be part of this incredible experience. And so that's the key to the show, is the invitation that everybody's brought in and really embraced. And everyone's pulling on the same side of the rope. And so I think I understood it was popular and getting popular, but I didn't know that it was a phenomena that was happening. And then of course, season three, you know, we get to the prison and Woodbury, and we're really starting to blow up, and the world is getting big. And so it was really an incredible experience that is the gift that keeps on giving. So the main thing about that, people always say, well, what'd you take from that? And friendships, you know, friendship with a guy like Vincent Ward, who played Oscar, my buddy. And again, you know, God rest his soul, but to spend time with Scott Wilson and you know, offset and dinners, hear about Burt Lancaster, you know, about In the Heat of the Night, or to hear about, you know, The Great Gatsby. And that was, you know, priceless. And so it was really a wonderful, wonderful experience. And I was really happy with what we did. Of course, I'd like to have been on longer. And I think that was always the idea, but they had painted themselves in a little bit of a corner when the governor showed up and they needed to have him draw some first blood, some blood that would hurt. And I drew the short straw. And, you know, you do a denial dance. You're like, oh, why don't you hire that? Why don't you nail that guy? He's an asshole. And they're like, no, we think it's you. And it wasn't me for the longest time. It was me and others that were being, some of them series regulars that were being considered. So they would come up to me after the news was out and amongst the set, and they'd say, oh, we're so sorry to hear about this. I'd be like, you have no idea how close it was to being you. So, but yeah, really wonderful experience. And that show has, man, what it's run and then the spinoffs. And I was talking to someone the other day, what's interesting, and you probably know this, Tracy, is that there's a whole new audience that's starting for it. So this is like a younger audience that is now 16 to 20 year olds that were in time, maybe a little young to watch it. And their whole binge has been around since that show 24, but you know, they can really snap into it really quickly and really capably and fast. And so they're getting it again. And, I have a whole group of younger people saying, hey, you're Axel, you did it, you know, and they're my daughter's age. So it is interesting. Yeah.
No, that's phenomenal. And to be a part of that is amazing. So you did excellent. I was hoping you would stay on longer, but.
Yeah, we were. And you know, when they came and they said, we're going to do this and anything you want to offer. And I was like, you guys are such good writers, but. I think if we could get a real shocking death scene, that would be awesome. And I'd always remembered those, I think they're the Zapruder tapes of the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah.
And it was just so shocking to see that headshot. And I was like, I think that would catch the audience's breath, you know? And so I was really proud how we were able to pull that off. And obviously Melissa McBride is such a big part of that as well.
Oh, wow. Oh, thank you for sharing. That's phenomenal. I'm just re-exploring the Walking Dead series, and I've been watching your episodes the last couple of nights. So
what fun. Yeah. Well, you know, Axel, I wanted him to be very gregarious and very much a guy that wore his heart on his sleeve, probably trying too hard to fit in, trying to ingratiate himself with people. I did want to reserve the, you know, some fangs, maybe some darkness in the closet in case they, the thing about that show, those writers could spin on you in a minute. And the next episode, you know, like one episode, I'm a drug addict. And the next thing I've been falsely incarcerated with a squirt gun, you know? And so it you have to be available, which was great, great exercise. And I think that's what made the show so interesting and engaging for the cast and the crew, and therefore, and it translates over into the finished product.
Right. Did you have any desire to transform into a zombie?
No. you know, I saw that so much every day, and what the work of that was, sitting in that chair at 4 and 5 in the morning getting built. And I was like, nah, I really I don't want to reanimate. So let's, just take him out, and that head will work. You know, you can't come back after the head's been damaged. So let's exactly. do that. But yeah, some of the cast really liked that. You know, I think Rooker really enjoyed it. It's too much makeup for my taste. Yeah.
I can't imagine the hours they would have to sit in the makeup chair just to get that look. And then taking it off, like, is the same thing. Process.
You know, and you'd be in a scene with a bunch of walkers behind a fence. And, you know, as the day wears on, you end up having conversations and current events and books. And then somebody would walk out at the end of the day, good night, Lou. And you'd be like, who is that? I'm the girl that was talking to you all day. I'm like, no way. Really? Wow. That's bizarre. I forgot there was a real human in that, all that makeup. My gosh. But they do an amazing job, and they work very hard at it. They take a lot of pride in their work. And there's a walker school about how to move and how to walk and the sounds to make. You don't get to just go put makeup on and get run out there. You really have to know the drill.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that was an amazing performance that you had. So,
oh, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that very much.
Lou, one final question and topic. It's a film that hasn't gotten a lot of attention. I just watched it a couple of months ago, though, Monstrous, from 2022. Really an interesting and unusual movie, and it's pretty much shown from the perspective of Christina Ricci throughout, and that perspective changes. You have a small role, but an important role in the film. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was a really wonderful experience. Again, working with someone like Christina Ricci, who is, she's just a powerhouse. I mean, her work speaks for itself. And we've been watching her since she's just a child, but she's every bit the craftsman that she's always been. And I think we're seeing that on this Yellow Jackets and numerous other things. I love that script, and I like the unraveling of what the, you know, the delusionment of what a tragedy can spin someone out with. And so this is a great study of that. And I think that's a fascinating, fascinating topic. And so I just really took to the script. So I was really excited. And Chris Silverstein, the director, I thought had a really good take on it. And it's a small movie, as you know. Ideally, we would have liked to have had more special effects resource available to us. But Christina does so much heavy lifting in this movie. I felt bad because I was like, man, she's doing all the work and we're only helping her just a little bit. So I showed up wanting to help a lot. And we rehearsed, and it was clear to me, you know, I've worked with Denzel and I've worked with McConaughey or some good players, and I could hold my own. And we did a few rehearsals and I was like, holy shit, this is where I just pass. I'm going to get the ball and pass to Christina. She's really good. And she was great. Really focused, real professional, and it just shows up in the work. And so I like this movie very much. We were doing that through COVID, so it was also a very difficult time to make movies and to be amongst, and everybody was nervous and wanting to be very safe. We got shut down a couple times because we had a couple of outbreaks, and so it was challenging, to say the least. I love that it's a period piece in the 50s, so to speak, that I think is always fun. Interesting Easter egg for you, Bruce, is there's a scene that you may remember where she's dancing in a bar, in a tavern, mm-hmm. with an older gentleman. That gentleman is the author of a book that got made into a movie, and I think it's called The Green Book. Green Room.
Yeah.
Green Book. Yeah. So he's actually the novelist.
Really?
So
that's a great movie. Yeah.
And so, and I think Christina's great in that. And I do think you're right. I don't think it gets enough attention. And I think it has better legs than that, you know. I think in time people will find it and do well with it. So I'm always interested in, you know, people will bring a movie like that up and I'm like, oh, how'd you see that? And pretty much everything's out there, but you have to look, right? You have to look.
It's on streaming, and it's definitely a movie I would recommend. I think it's well done. It's not horrific or violent, really.
Yeah,
it's a subtle film, and it's got some surprises along the way.
Yeah. So I think that's fun. I like ghost stories. I would say that if you do those really well, then you're really good, to be honest. Yeah. You know, they're not, everybody feels like they can do them great, but there's a certain skill set I think you need for to do the Ghost and Mrs. Muir, you know, Sixth Sense.
Yeah.
You know, those are really great, because you've got to earn the audience's belief and take them on the ride, and then you got them, right? You know, so.
Yeah,
I read an awful lot of them. There's some really great ones on the page, and they're mostly, it's just about the time and resource that you have to make them.
Lou, you've been really generous with your time. We appreciate your stories, your insight. This has been wonderful. Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It's always a delight. I'll be happy to come back anytime. Big fan of the show. You guys do a great job. You're out there promoting the genre, which is alive and well, as you know, amongst all of these dead things. And so there's a lot to talk about. You know, I don't know how you keep it all sorted and compartmentalized. And there's just always interesting little tidbit. I did a short film, a favor for a casting director. I showed up down at Chapman University for some kids to make a small little indie that would go on to play at festivals. It was called Laura Hasn't Slept, and it is the precursor to a movie called Smile. Did you see Smile?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and that movie's gone on to do, it did very well. I think they marketed the heck out of that. It's Parker Finney. He's a very good filmmaker. And I think they're doing Smile too. The thing about this is you just never know. I did a very small movie called The Endless, which I just adore. It's a science fiction, very H.P. Lovecraft for two young men, Aaron Moorhead and Justin Benson. They went on to make a movie called Synchronic, Jamie Dornan and Anthony Mackie. And but now they have a series called Loki, which is, I think, Marvel. Yeah. And so you just never know who the next Duffer Brothers are, or who the next, you know, Rob Zombie or Eli Roth is.
I lost you at the very end there, Lou. But I do want to reiterate some of the films that you mentioned. The short video, Laura Hasn't Slept. The other film you mentioned was Endless. And these are just two of the many credits that Lou Temple has accumulated in his prolific career. He's coming in on 150 film and TV credits. Lou, great job. Thank you. Well, Lou, we really do appreciate it. Continued best of luck, success in your career. Thanks to Lou Temple, our guest on this edition of the podcast. As always, want to thank my co-host and producer, Tracy Asteria, as well. We thank all of you for joining us right here in this Museum of the Macabre, and we hope you'll join us again next time right here in the Ghostly Gallery.